Good morning, everybody. We are in Judges chapter 19 this morning. And we're entering into the final story of the book of Judges. I'm going to warn you as we go into this story that this is a very graphic and difficult story. It is possibly one of the most graphic stories in the Bible. If I'll just tell you personally, this is the only story in the Bible that I find more difficult than this one is the crucifixion. This story really hits hard. It is going to include rape and dismemberment. Because we've reached the part of the book where Israel is entirely indistinguishable from the heathen. Right, again, this is, I think I said this at the beginning of our class, however many weeks ago. This is the point where, like you remember in George Orwell's Animal Farm, right, like how one of the big deals is that they are, you know, the animals are distinguishing themselves from the humans and showing that they can run the farm better than humans can and more humanely than humans can. Of course, over the course of the book, you can see them doing more and more things that are shady, things that they would have complained about the human farmer doing, until at the very end of the book, you've got all the pigs going in negotiating with all of these humans to cut some deal, and whenever they come out, the rest of the farm animals can't tell the difference between the pigs and the humans because the pigs are walking on their hind legs. This is, we've hit the point here where the pigs are walking on their hind legs in Israel. As we begin reading, we're going to notice some familiar elements to the story. In fact, some stuff is just going to remind us immediately of the last story that we read on Thursday about the young Levite in the tribe of Dan. This story is going to involve another Levite traveling from Bethlehem through the tribe of Ephraim. So a lot of the framing is the same. Is the last story. But we're going to notice stuff from other parts of the book as well, because the author of Judges is going to tie in practically every thread that we have picked up over the course of studying the book of Judges, along with some things that we picked up in our study of the Law of Moses. So I'm going to try to point out what I think are the most fruitful connections along the way to kind of increase our understanding of the story. But there is, I'll just say there's really no way to fully do justice to a story like this in just a single reading over a handful of classes. So I encourage you, as difficult as the story is, it is really important for understanding the nature of Israel in the Old Testament. And so I encourage you to return to it in your own private study. You know, reread these three chapters and wrestle with them. So, that being said, let's begin reading our text. Judges 19, beginning in verse 1. In those days when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, who took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. And his concubine was unfaithful to him. And she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there some 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. He had with him his servant and a couple of donkeys. And she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him. And his father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and spent the night there. And on the fourth day, they arose early in the morning, and he prepared to go. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that you may go." So the two of them sat and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Be pleased to spend the night, and let your heart be merry." And when the man rose up to go, his father-in-law pressed him till he spent the night there again. And on the fifth day, he arose early in the morning to depart. And the girl's father said, "Strengthen your heart and wait until the day declines." So they ate, both of them. And when the man and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold, now the day has waned toward evening. Please spend the night, Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here, let your heart be merry, and tomorrow you shall arise early in the morning for your journey and go home. But the man would not spend the night. He rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. He had with him a couple of saddled donkeys, and his concubine was with him. When they were near Jebus, the day was nearly over, and his servant said to his master, "Come now, let us turn aside to the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." And his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners, who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah." And he said to his young man, "Come and let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or at Ramah." So they passed on and went their way. And the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. Behold, an old man was coming from his work in the field at evening. The man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was sojourning in Gibeah. The men of the place were Benjaminites. He lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, "Where are you going? Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "We're passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to the house of the Lord. But no one has taken me into his house. We have straw and feed for our donkeys, with bread and wine for me and your female servant and the young man with your servants. There's no lack of anything." And the old man said, "Peace be to you. I will care for all your wants. Only do not spend the night in the square." So he brought them into his house and gave the donkeys feed, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. So this story begins like the last story in the middle of things. And like the last story involves, like we said, a Levite, Bethlehem of Judah, the tribe of Ephraim. This Levite, we learn, has a concubine who is unfaithful to him. So he goes to reconcile with her at her father's house in Bethlehem. We should pay attention to the way that the Levite treats this concubine, because think of how often in the Old Testament marriage is a metaphor for the Lord's relationship with Israel. Right, being a concubine in antiquity, she's still afforded marital rights, right? But she's essentially a second-class wife. We should pay attention to the way that this Levite treats this concubine, because we can do some comparing and contrasting here. So far, things sound pretty nice, and things almost even sound sweet, right? This is a story that up to this point should be familiar to us from the prophets. So for example, if we're familiar with the story of Hosea, or if we are familiar with things that the Lord has said about Israel in Ezekiel, for example, right? This is a familiar story. This woman is unfaithful to the Levite, and she goes off and ends up returning to her father's house. And so this Levite follows her to reconcile with her, to win her back. He arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and to bring her back. Right, so it sounds nice at this point. I want us to keep track of that. We might also hear some echoes at this point of Samson's story and how Samson returns to the Timnite's house to try to reclaim his wife. But the picture here is far more friendly than what we found in Timnah. The father-in-law welcomes the Levite in, right? Whereas with Samson, Samson's father-in-law held him back and said, "No, I actually gave her to another guy." This guy, this Ephraimite, or not, sorry, this the father-in-law in Bethlehem in Judah is hospitable to the Levite. In fact, he's very hospitable. We get this threefold repetition of how hospitable this guy is and how well this guy treats the Levite. Right? The Levite stays with his father-in-law for 3 days, eating and drinking. And then a fourth day, and then a fifth. Right? It's like this Levite can hardly get away from his father-in-law's house. And there's nothing exactly sinister about this. Right? The guy is just being hospitable to his son-in-law. And celebrating the fact that his daughter has been reconciled back to him. Yeah?
It's almost, well, it reminds me of, it kind of has the echoes of Jacob and Laban. Laban keeps wanting him to stay and he wants him to stay.
Perhaps, yeah. And that's, I think, as we consider that story next to this one, we notice some important differences. So, like, you've got that similarity where, yeah, Jacob can hardly get away from Laban. Laban doesn't want to let him go. But when we consider these two stories together, we should also, I think, notice some important differences where Laban very obviously and transparently is trying to keep Jacob around because the Lord has blessed Laban on Jacob's account. Right, whenever Laban sees Jacob, he gets dollar signs in his eyes. And he doesn't want to let him go because he hasn't finished milking him yet. We don't get that sense here from this man in Bethlehem who just won't let his son-in-law go. Like, there's no apparent ulterior motive like there is in Laban's case. I think that's an important contrast to make. And we draw this out because this guy's hospitality is going to be contrasted over and against something else later in the chapter. All right, so the Levite refuses to stay a fifth night and instead departs in the evening. And as the light begins to dim, perhaps at this point our sense of dread might begin to increase in the story. Because the Levite has to choose where to find lodging for the night. And again, he's traveling from Bethlehem in Judah. He passes by Jerusalem. And he is, again, that puts him relatively close to Benjamin. In fact, you'll remember in the book of Joshua, the tribal inheritance lists in Joshua placed Jerusalem inside of Benjamin. So we're really close to this border, or like right at this border between Judah and Benjamin. So he's passing by Jerusalem, and at this point in Israel's history, Jerusalem is not under Israel's control. It is a Jebusite city. And so the Levite refuses to stay there explicitly because it is a city of foreigners. And we don't want to stay overnight among foreigners. And he doesn't state exactly what it is about these foreigners that makes him not want to stay there, but what kinds of implications do we get from this? I mean, why would this Levite not want to turn aside to a city of foreigners? Why would he instead prefer a city of Israelites? What do you guys think? Rena?
He figured they'd be more decent than him.
That's what you would think. In fact, we could frame this in modern terms. We usually don't face these same kinds of decisions, mainly because we have cars and, you know, we can go pretty much anywhere we want. But imagine you're faced with a choice, you know, say you're traveling out in the wilderness somewhere and you've got to pick a group of people to stay with. And on the one hand, you've got a church. On the other hand, you've got a mosque. Right? And who are you naturally going to feel more affinity for? Who are you going to feel safer with? Right? You might, in fact, there was a period in our recent history where people would have felt endangered by being near a mosque. Right? This guy, we're not going to turn aside to the city of foreigners. Instead, we're going to pass on to Gibeah, right? The city in, or this town in Benjamin. We're going to go to a proper, decent Israelite place. In other words, let's see. Now, this turns, of course, this becomes ironic later in the chapter because of what happens to them in Gibeah. So, the Levite and his party arrive at Gibeah as the sun sets over them. And per the ancient norm, they sit in the town square, waiting for somebody to take them in. We've seen this kind of thing happen before in the Old Testament. Right, you're sojourning through a strange town, you don't have a place to stay, and so you sit in the town square and somebody hospitable will invite you in. Just normal ancient custom. Except here, none of the townspeople, none of the men of Benjamin, offer these guys hospitality. It's not like it's a big bunch of people that they have to host either. It is two men and a woman. Right, the Levite, his servant, and the concubine, along with two donkeys. And as the Levite himself explains, they've got the materials to take care of themselves, right? We've got straw and feed for our donkeys. We've got bread and wine for me and for the concubine, for the servant. Anybody who hosts them literally just has to put a roof over their heads. They're not going to be out anything. But none of the men of Benjamin offer them any hospitality. It takes another sojourner in the town, an Ephraimite who has, for reasons we don't know, resettled there in Gibeah of Benjamin. It takes this old Ephraimite farmer to offer them a place with him. And you might notice the way that he acts about this. He's insistent. Right, I'll take care of all your wants, just don't spend the night in the square. Now, as we're considering this part of the story, right, you've got these sojourners coming in, they're sitting in the square, looking for somebody to take them in, looking for hospitality, nobody is offering it, so it looks like they're going to have to spend the night sleeping in the square. Until another sojourner in the town invites them in. What story does this immediately put in mind for us?
Lot.
The story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Not exactly the sort of reminder that you want floating around in your head, but we will see where the story goes with this. All right, so you remember in Genesis 19, the angels of the Lord are sojourning through the city of Sodom, and Lot is waiting at the gate, and he sees them come into town, and he invites them into his house for the night, and he, like this old Ephraimite, is insistent, don't spend the night in the square. But of course, we find out why he is so insistent later in the night. We'll see what we find out here. Any questions or comments, though, before we move on to the last half of the chapter? Saul?
So, I guess before we move on, Lot is called righteous by Paul, right?
I forget who calls him that, but yeah, righteous Lot was, I want to say Peter called him that. But anyway, he is called righteous in the New Testament.
Yeah, I believe that comes from, either from the Targum or some kind of commission. Oh, the Book of Jubilee.
Yeah. Yeah, where he's portrayed in the New Testament as agonizing over the wickedness of the people that are living around him.
So that leads me to believe that Lot's intention was different than the intention maybe here.
Go ahead.
Because Lot's intention may have been he had no choice but to do that, you know.
To take the angels in, or to move?
To take the angels in and have to give his daughters.
Oh, right.
Not knowing, you know. I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah, the question of Lot's daughters and his offering them to the men of Sodom is, I mean, that's kind of a fraught question, because we do have to remember he is trying to protect these strangers who were in his house. Mm-hmm. So he's, I think the best way I've heard it explained is that he is essentially backed into a corner here, where none of his options are good. Ultimately, because of his earlier choice to settle in Sodom to begin with. Right? Because Abraham, remember when they're dividing up the land, Abraham gives him the choice, right? You can live up here, live over here. And Lot takes none of the choices that Abraham gives him, and instead is casting his eyes over toward Sodom, where the land looks good. In fact, I think there's even more parallels to consider between Lot and Judges, because what gets Lot into Sodom is the land looks good in his eyes. He did what was right in his own eyes, and it lands him in this dire situation where he ends up doing something that, you know, I think we ought to look down on in an attempt to try to save his guests. But then the whole situation is reversed when it turns out that the guests are angels and they're here to save him. I want us to hold on to a lot of those things that as we continue through this story to see if those same kind of dynamics play out. So, good point. Yeah,
did
Louise?
Did Lot know that they were angels?
Did Lot know? Not initially, no.
Because I would think that he would be sacrificing his children for his daughters because of the angels. I don't know.
At that point, I don't think that we're given to understand that he knows that they're angels. He's just trying to protect men, people that he thinks are men who are his guests. And it's his job as host to protect them at any cost to himself. So, again, the offer that Lot makes is not something that we're supposed to have warm and fuzzy thoughts about. We're supposed to see it as tragic. Now, we're going to... I want us to hold on to that because we're going to see something very similar in this chapter. So, I think it's good for us to consider Lot's offer because we're going to see something very similar here. Any other questions or comments before we move on? Okay. Let's go to verse 22. Here's where it gets bad. As they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, worthless fellows, surrounded the house, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, bring out the man who came into your house, that we may know him. And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not do this vile thing. Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out now. Violate them and do with them what seems good to you. But against this man, do not do this outrageous thing. But the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine and made her go out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night until the morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. And as morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was, until it was light. And the master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, get up, let us be going. But there was no answer. Then he put her on the donkey, and the man rose up and went away to his home. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, and taking hold of his concubine, he divided her, limb by limb, into 12 pieces, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And all who saw it said, such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak. So, if we recognize the framing of, you know, from Sodom and Gomorrah, then we perhaps anticipated what was going to happen next. The men of the city begin beating on the old Ephraimite's door, and they start making exactly the same demand that the men of Sodom made of Lot. Bring your guests out so that we can know them. Except this isn't Sodom. This is Gibeah of Benjamin, an Israelite city where this is happening. But the parallels continue, though. This old Ephraimite, like Lot, goes out and implores the men of the town not to violate his guest. Instead, take the women. And just like Lot, the Ephraimite makes this offer. And the men of Gibeah, like the men of Sodom, refuse. At this point, though, the two stories diverge from each other. It's at this point in the Sodom story that the angels bail Lot out. Right? The men of Sodom get angry with Lot, and they're coming for him. And the angels reach out, and they grab Lot and pull him back into the house. And then they strike the men of Sodom blind. And it's at this point that the true nature of what's going on is revealed. Right? Lot thinks that he's saving his guests, but his guests are actually there to save him. And so he gathers up his wife and his daughters, and they flee the city. And of course, Lot's wife gets salty about it. And then judgment is rained down on the city. Right? As Lot and his daughters flee, the angels of the Lord return to Sodom and Gomorrah in wrath and destroy it in fire and brimstone. Now, we're going to see what happens here in terms of the interaction with the guests. We'll also, I think, need to pay attention to the Lord's reaction. Because, again, if we're reading this in light of Sodom and Gomorrah, maybe we have certain expectations about what ought to happen. Right? If Sodom and Gomorrah were to be destroyed because of their great wickedness, certainly Gibeah deserves the same fate. We'll see what happens to Gibeah. But at this point, again, the story diverges. The guests can't rescue their host. So the Levite's concubine is forced out. If you notice the language of it, the man seized his concubine and sent her out. And the men of Gibeah apparently changed their minds about her. And the book does not spare us the horror of what happens to her. As we've said, the man seizes this woman to force her outside. The violation begins inside the house. But then the men of Gibeah rape the Levite's concubine and beat her up all through the night. Spend the entire night doing this. Don't let her go until the first light of day. So as morning approaches, this poor woman drags herself to the door of the house and falls down with her hands on the threshold. In the meanwhile, what's the Levite doing in the meanwhile? I mean, he had been, before all of this started, he had been eating and drinking, they were making their hearts merry.
The guy was just sleeping.
The guy got a good night's sleep. The Levite enjoys security inside the house while his concubine is being raped and beaten to death outside. He gets up in the morning, ready to leave as if nothing has happened. And look at his callousness. He opens up the door and finds this woman lying there with her hands on the threshold, and what does he do? Get up. Time for us to get going. This is the kind of thing that perhaps ought to go through our heads whenever we hear the parable of the Good Samaritan, by the way. Because you'll remember who passes by that robbed man. A priest and a Levite who are as callous as this man is. Get up, let's get going. But there was no answer. The old Greek supplies that there was no answer because she was dead. The Hebrew does not tell us that. It just says there was no answer. It does not tell us that she was dead at this point. We're not told this explicitly one way or the other. The Hebrew text does not tell us when this woman dies. But what's left open is the possibility that the Levite dismembers this woman alive. Because that's what the Levite does. Like, when he reaches home, again, he seizes his concubine. Our ESV is translated a little different. When he returned to his house, he took a knife and taking hold of his concubine. But it's the same Hebrew word that was used in verse 25, where he seized her and threw her outside. Here he seizes her again to cut her into pieces. And he sends these 12 pieces out through Israel as a call to arms. Now, before we get into chapter 20, I want to consider some big picture issues from this text, and I doubt we'll be able to finish this in today's class. First, I want us to consider how the book of Judges has been setting us up and building us up to this particular story. Right, going all the way back to chapter 1, when the tribe of Judah cuts off the thumbs and the big toes of Adoni-Bezek. Right? We kind of made a big deal about it. Hold on. We made a big deal about it back there in chapter 1. Right, because the law doesn't justify Judah's actions. We just see, honestly, some pointless violence coming out of Judah. And it kind of made us scratch our heads, like, oh, wait a minute. And they're treating Adoni-Bezek like a dog, just like he himself had treated those other 70 kings like dogs. All right? We should point out, by the way, that there's another example in the Old Testament of someone sending a message to Israel through dismemberment. There's only one other example. It's Saul in 1 Samuel chapter 11. Only there he dismembers an ox and sends all the pieces out throughout Israel as a call to war. Judges 19 is the only place where we find a person being treated in this way. Israel has reached its absolute lowest in this story. But that the senseless violence, the cruelty have been there since the beginning of the book, if we had eyes to see it. We should remember also the story of Ehud, right? A Benjaminite, not coincidentally. We have Benjamin close to the beginning of the book, and now Benjamin again close to the end. We're going to have more to say about this connection over the next couple of chapters. But I want us to remember, and this is the last thing we'll mention today, remember the way that the narrator used double entendre to describe the way that Ehud killed King Eglon. All right, the sword is bound to Ehud's loins, and he goes to Eglon secretly, and he drives the sword into Eglon's womb, right? Remembering that the Hebrew word for stomach is the same as the word for womb. All right, we noted, again, it's all presented humorously back in chapter 3. The Spirit, through the narrator, I think, is giving us just enough rope to hang ourselves with. Right, if we thought it was funny in chapter 3, we're certainly not laughing now. That we find this woman being raped to death. Yes, ma'am.
What seems senseless about this is that this Levite went there to reconcile with her, speaking kindly to her, then suddenly he's...
Then throws her out.
...to get raped, then he cuts her body off? I don't get it.
That's what I was going to say.
Dwell on that this week. We're out of time. But that is something to dwell on because, again, remember how the Lord treats Israel. How he has been treating Israel through the book of Judges. When Israel is unfaithful to him, and he gives them over in the hands of plunderers, they cry out, what is God's response? What has God's response been every single time in the book of Judges up to this point? He saves them. And they don't deserve it.
I just have one last thing.
Yeah.
This is like a super common theme, and I'm seeing it here. In every time there's some kind of sexual issue,
yeah,
there's always wine involved, always alcohol.
Yeah.
And right here it says, so he took him to the house, gave the donkey's water, and then washed their feet and ate and drank.
Yeah.
And when they celebrated, then you have all this happen. And And not only that, but it's like the same thing in Genesis, where you have Noah's son.
Yeah. Well, Noah's passed out drunk. Yeah. There's, yeah, there's some, I think that might, yeah, that, I think that's a fruitful connection.
Yeah.
So, excellent. Yeah, that we very often see an association between sexual sin and drunkenness in the Old Testament. All right, we got to stop it there. We're already over time. We will wrap this up and get into chapter 20 on Thursday, Lord willing. Thank you so much for your kind attention this morning.